Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte may look shiny, new, and modern, but if you peel back a layer or two, you're going to find history. The city has a history. Telling the story of that history and working to preserve it is the mission of the Charlotte Museum of History. And for just over 2 years, the job of running that museum has fallen to Terry White, their president and CEO. In her short time at the helm, she's made some notable accomplishments, among them moving the more than 100-year-old Siloam School, one of the oldest African-American schools in Mecklenburg County, from the Mallard Creek area to its new home just outside the museum. And now, Terry White is turning her attention to restoring the oldest home in the county, the Hezekiah Alexander House. And she has more on her plate, including dealing with the kind of challenges every organization must contend with, and a few others that are particular to a history museum. So this hour, we're going to explore those things and ask someone consumed with historic preservation for her vision for the future. Terry White, welcome to the program. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
A little history about you first. Prior to your arrival in Charlotte, you held positions at the Heinz History Center in Pittsburgh and the Carnegie Science Center in Pittsburgh, and then moved on to the Smithsonian, my favorite museum, the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. These are big places. What attracted you to Charlotte and to the Charlotte Museum of History?
Wow. So I actually started at Smithsonian and then went to Pittsburgh. And I really love museums. It's a dream career, honestly. But I had reached a point in my professional development that I wasn't getting the growth that I was looking forward to as a young person, you know, really working hard in my field. So I switched industries altogether. And there's a long story that explains the connection, but I went into supply chain technology.
Oh my God.
And there is a story that makes it make sense. But I came to Charlotte to work in supply chain. So I started with Lowe's, worked there for a few months, and then I went on to a whole Delhaize, which is the company that owns Food Lion, and American Tire distributors, all working in supply chain and project management and product management work. And while I really was good at the job and I worked with great people, I wasn't excited to call my friends and say, oh my God, guess what? I took my project from yellow to green. Let's talk about it. That's just not the kind of girl talk material. And so I said to my best friend, you know, if a job in Charlotte in the museum world opens up where I won't take too huge of a salary hit, because, you know, working in tech, that's a different salary range. I'm just going to go ahead and apply. And 3 weeks later, I was looking for something to do over the weekend, went to the Charlotte Museum of History's website and saw this job opening. So my first thought was, oh my God, is the universe pranking me? There's no way this job is open. But then I applied and said, the worst they can say is kick rocks. And thankfully, they didn't. And it's been a wild journey ever since.
You are a young person. You're still a young person. People can't tell that necessarily on the radio because they can't see you. But your love for museums, and you just said you love museums, your love for museums started when you were a child. And I would wager, correct me if I'm wrong, that more children go to museums than almost adults because field trips take them there. I grew up
Absolutely.
In the D.C. area, and we went to the Smithsonian every single year. And some of the kids in the class loved going. Other kids found it to be drudgery. All they wanted to do was go to the snack bar and sit in the corner on the floor. So what is it about museums that, as a child, made you excited?
Wow. Well, one, you're absolutely right. Children are probably as a history museum, our second largest demographic of who actually walks through the door because of field trips. But for me, it was just so exciting to see art and history and artifacts from eras of time, places around the world that I hadn't been. I hadn't, I was only reading about them in books. And then to see it in real life and how people interpret the world around them through objects and through their culture and heritage. It just always fascinated me from this the stuffed animals. They're not stuffed animals. Taxidermy. There you go. That's the word. Taxidermy animals to mummies to, pop art. It just always felt like a glimpse of the world beyond where I live. And it always excited me. And so when you talk about the kids who loved the field trips versus the kid who was like, oh my God, why are we here? I was absolutely the first person to turn in my permission slip. Mom, we're going to the art museum. Mom, we're going to the science center. That was 100% me.
Local historian Dan Morrill, who I'm sure you've are aware of if you haven't met him already, I'm sure you've met him too, but he once chided me because on the air I said that Charlotte has no history because it just tears it down to put up skyscrapers and gleaming buildings. And I did have a friend who came to town from New York and said, "Where's old Charlotte? Because everything looks brand spanking new." He chided me because he insists that we can find history all over Charlotte. You just got to know where to look for it. But it is increasingly difficult, it seems to me. How do you see the Charlotte Museum of History filling in the blanks of that history to give people a sense of place, where they live and where it came from?
So I think the museum does that in two ways. One is through our exhibit and programs that really give a direct window into specific aspects of a Charlotte and Piedmont region history. And since I've been here, we try to rotate those as frequently as we can, and we also try to highlight history that is often overlooked. There are a lot of people who, when they think of history museums, they think of wooden and glass cases with dusty objects inside of them, and you're not allowed to touch anything, and it's very solemn and very mausoleum-like. And there are objects and themes that need to be handled that way, but most history should and could be exciting and engaging. So that's one way that we try to meet people where they are with the, learning the history of the city that they were either born in or have chosen to make home. It's through our exhibitry and programs. But secondly, as you mentioned earlier, we're really big on historic preservation of objects and items, yes, but especially of Charlotte's built environment. There unfortunately have been a lot of really beautiful historic buildings that have been lost, and we can't do anything about those. But what we can do is say, wait, save this one because of da 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 da. And give those reasons and really honor the people and companies who do that work, because it's a lot easier to tear something down and build something new rather than take the time and frankly resources to convert something historic into something usable for people today. And so we really highlight historic preservation. We provide workshops for people so that they can learn how to do smaller projects on their own homes or businesses, but then really honor the larger projects that have tried to keep the character in Charlotte as we move and grow as a city.
You talked about wanting to come back to the world of museums after you moved here and lucking into this essentially job. You just on the surfing the web and there was the job opportunity and you had that experience under your belt and you applied and here you are. I'm sure you did some homework on this. What did you see as the biggest opportunity for you as a museum director in taking over the Charlotte Museum of History?
Wow. So one thing that I always remind people is I am not a historian, not at least a formally trained one. I am a person who loves history and who researches history because I'm the nerd that does that. But I, all my education, all my training, my professional background is in business. It's in financial management, operations, logistics, that sort of thing. And what I think that I could bring, and what I feel I've brought thus far, and hope I will continue to bring, is the reminder that these operations don't work on vibes and good feelings and, mission. You have to be business minded to keep the doors open, especially as a nonprofit. And so I think really, one, changing the internal culture to change how people think about money, how people think about the exhibits and programs and projects that we take on, beyond, oh, is it cool? Let's look at the financial and more qualitative business aspects of it that will help the organization grow and sustain beyond our time there.
And I want
So
to
I
talk.
would say,
I want to talk about
oh,
that l later in
please.
the program, at some length. But I was having a conversation last night with Julie Eiselt, who used to be a city council member and mayor pro tem, and we were talking about nonprofits, and we were talking about the fact that you were going to be on the program today. And she said, "Yeah, nonprofits, that's a tough slog. There's not a lot of money to go around." And you come from having worked in Pittsburgh, where there is a tradition of philanthropy. I mean, the Carnegie family, etc. There's a lot of philanthropy money, not so much here. Has that been a challenge?
I'll say it's an opportunity. I
Yeah.
think that one of the things I've had to learn as an outsider is there is absolutely a Charlotte way of doing things.
Yes,
It
there
doesn't
is.
matter how solid your business plan is. People want to know you. They want to know and believe in the person behind the plan. And that's fine. You want to be friends? Great. I'll be in your face until we get this work done. But I think it's just a matter of changing the culture here. We did have a time period where people weren't as invested in keeping history together, but that's something that's changing, and hopefully that philanthropic landscape here will grow so that in the future Charlotte can match other cities where that's more the norm.
And we will continue that part of the conversation a little bit later on. I want to take a look at seeing history through different lenses and some of the preservation efforts that you have been directly involved in since taking over this when we come back with Terry White, the president and CEO of the Charlotte Museum of History on Charlotte Talks here on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins here with Terry White. She is the president and CEO of the Charlotte Museum of History. Several years ago, you told Queen City Metro that you love showing people that museums aren't these boring places that they might have visited as a child in school. You say, quote, these are vibrant organizations that tell us the background of every aspect of our lives, which fits right in, I guess, to the mission of the Charlotte Museum of History, its updated mission, which is, as I understand it, to inspire community engagement and create common ground through education and storytelling. But how? Museums are, at the very foundation, collections of objects, artifacts. How do you make them engaging?
Absolutely. Well, the first thing is that historically museums just have this bad rep of stealing things from anybody and everybody to create these cool collections that wealthy people could gawk at. And if you didn't get it, then there was something wrong with you. That's the 50,000 foot summary of the old way of museuming. But today, museums are doing a lot of the hard work. One, to look at their collections and determine, hey, did we get these items the correct way, and getting them back to the people and cultures that rightfully own them. But also reminding people that these objects don't mean anything if people can't see them, if people can't interpret them, if people can't engage with them. And so it's not fun to walk into a place and you have to keep your hands to yourself and not talk and just look around and really not understand what you're looking at. Museums today, including Charlotte Museum of History, but I think all museums are about really making people understand that whatever their niche topic is, here's how it connects to you, and here's how you can learn more about it. Yes, through traditional exhibits with artifacts that you cannot and should not touch, but also through interactive elements that you can and are encouraged to touch and interact with, to make it a more fun, tactile, full sensory experience for everybody. So that's just really the direction the industry has leaned into the last 20 years. And so if you haven't been in a museum since you were in third grade, now's the time to go out there and explore what we're doing.
Okay. For people who don't know, and there are probably people who don't know where the Charlotte Museum of History is located, it's out there on Shamrock Drive in East Charlotte. It's been there since 1976. How would you describe, for those who are newcomers to town or for those who have not been to the museum, what it is you offer and how it works?
So we are an 8-acre campus in East Charlotte, as you said. We're not in Narnia. It's 8 minutes from Uptown if you get in your car and come to us. Free parking, that's always a good thing to mention. But we take care of the oldest home in Mecklenburg County, as well as other 18th century related structures. We are sort of an escape into nature inside of an urban jungle. And we have a museum building that really looks like a presidential palace, but that inside we try anyway to have a rotation of exhibits and programs that go beyond wars and generals and presidents and some of the more traditional historic topics to really engage with the people of the Queen City today. And connecting them to people of the Queen City before.
History has become
That's the PR bite.
History has become this kind of touchy subject for many in recent years, and history is obviously portrayed through specific lenses. Usually, the lens of the victor, if it's a war, they get to write the history books about that war. But in recent years, there have been attempts to both expand the number of lenses that we see history through, different points of view, and that has resulted in some people saying, no, this is how it was, and this is what I want taught, this is what I want in the textbooks. How, what's your approach to that? How do you fight that? How do you, what's behind that? Is it fear of learning something that disagrees with what you were taught when you were in the 12th grade? I mean, what is that about?
I think it's a little bit of fear. I think change is uncomfortable for all people and in all areas of life. So if you've gone 60, 70, 80 years believing one thing, to have that be juxtaposed next to something that you may not have known or may not agree with can be jarring. I've definitely been called woke by more than a few people since I've been here. For daring to tell stories beyond just Hezekiah Alexander. But,
For instance, what kind of stories?
well, what we, you know, Hezekiah did a lot of stuff for the backcountry and for North Carolina, and we have never not shared that story. But he was not operating on an island by himself. He had a wife, so we talk about women's history and the role of women throughout Charlotte's history. He had 10 children. So, what did does it mean to be a child in 17? Have we supported children through education and resources and opportunities over 250 years? He also enslaved, factually, nobody's making it up, 17 people. And so, what were their lives like? What was it like to be owned by somebody else and to not have that autonomy over your future? It's not a lie. It's not infactual. It happened. But because we dare speak about these things that happen to other people, there are people who are upset about it. And to me, it doesn't tarnish Hezekiah's legacy. No one's sitting around, oh, Hezekiah, he's burning in hell. Like, no, it's that's not it at all. We're not here to pass judgment. We're here to present facts and provide insight to lenses from the same time period that may otherwise have gone ignored.
We had one of the people who's responsible for running Monticello on the program several years ago, and they have taken this tact as well, because Thomas Jefferson, despite the fact that he wrote the Declaration of Independence and fought to get the abolition of slavery into that document, was unsuccessful at it. He himself owned slaves. They built and ran Monticello. He would not have had the success that he had without that labor, that unvolunteer labor, unpaid unvolunteer labor. And they have acknowledged that. They have embraced that, and it's become a key part of when you tour Monticello now, that aspect of how it ran. And I think the same is true of Mount Vernon, which was George Washington's home elsewhere in Virginia. It seems to me that this, although it may contradict what your set mindset on this is, it expands your view. It gives you a better understanding of what that time was
Absolutely.
like. It's not a condemnation. They lived in a different time.
Agreed. And I think it, to the point, I think it expands the view of what life was like back then. A lot of people seem to think that there was just this very Bridgerton, prim and posh kind of everyone just walking around. But no, people were living everyday lives. And if anything, if we really believe that we are in a society where we have moved away from racism and sexism and all of the isms that hold us back, if you truly believe that, being able to show, look how far we've come in 250 years. We don't have slaves in America. We don't honor only wealthy white landowners. We honor everybody through our institutions and the things that we invest in. If we are saying that's the society that we live in, looking at the past accurately and completely should serve as sort of a final point to say, look, we have grown and progressed since then. And I think it's the responsibility of institutions like mine and other museums and organizations to take us even further, because the things that we're doing today in 10, 15, 50 years are going to be the historic moments that people are looking back at. And so it's an ongoing cycle of if we are looking at ourselves to be this ideal society, we can't shy away from the things that make us uncomfortable or that make us angry or that make us sad. We have to be honest about them. Otherwise, we're not going to move forward. So if you really believe that our society has changed for the better, why not show how far we've come so that we can create a foundation to keep growing beyond?
I want to talk about one of the things that you recently accomplished, and it's significant because it took a long time to make this happen. You moved this whole building to your campus, the Siloam School. You moved it from its original location in the Mallard Creek area to your campus on Shamrock Drive. Talk about the significance of this school building. If you look at the before pictures, you'd think, what? They're gonna just implode it, tear it down. But no, it was valuable enough to move it. So talk about why it needed to be moved and why.
Absolutely. So first, I will take credit for only the last 25% of this project. Three other presidents before me really started the work and recognized that this was something to be saved. I was just the one that said, listen, it's going to get moved or we're going to move on. And the reason why it needed to be saved, it was one of these Rosenwald era schools, one room schoolhouses built for Black children in an era of segregation when they weren't allowed to attend school with white children or children of other races. And what was special about this particular school was that from all the research we've done, although they used Rosenwald plans, it was the only one that we can tell locally that didn't use Rosenwald funds to actually build the school.
Let me stop for just a second for those people who are not aware of what the Rosenwald schools are, because we did a whole hour on this with the former employee at the Charlotte Observer, Fanny Flono, who was one of the people spearheading these efforts to preserve these Rosenwald schools. These were schools that were built through money provided by the head of Sears and Roebuck back in the early 20th century for black children who could not go to white schools. And they came up with this floor plan for these. I guess it was kind of like a two-room schoolhouse that had various grades mixed into it. And although this school, the Siloam School, did not get funds from the Rosenwald Fund, they used the floor plan for this. So it's
Correct.
that same era. So when was it built?
We believe it was finished around 1923, 1924. It was definitely open for the 1923-24 school year. We know where the lumber came from. It came from a local company. The people who built this was all community driven. And so when that school opened on opening day, that is what we tried to recreate with the restoration. The life of the building has been a very interesting one. It was a school for about 30 years. Then it became a private residence. Then it became an auto garage. And then it sat abandoned for a few decades. And so if you saw the before pictures, like you mentioned, it just looked like a Wicked Witch shack or something. It didn't resemble a school. It didn't resemble anything. But that was years, 8 years, in fact, of research, talking with the community. We found as far as we know, the only living alum from the school who actually attended Siloam as a child. We spoke to the family who lived in the home when it was a home and who sold it so that it could become an auto garage. We did archaeology. We just really went into the history of this structure. It connected it to people and everyday things so that the building could come to life. The way that it looks today, it is mostly original. Everything that we could salvage, we salvaged. It has a green roof because when we peeled back layers of roofs that were added on, we found this beautiful green roofing shingle that was original to the building. So we color matched that. We used linseed oil paint to paint the school because that's what would have been used 100 years ago. It really, to us, is a labor of love. Yes, to save a building, but not just save a building for building's sake, but saving it so that the stories of the people connected to that structure wouldn't have been lost had we lost that school.
I have about a minute left in this segment, and your museum has traditionally focused on the colonial Revolutionary War era of Charlotte. One of the centerpieces is this diorama of Charlotte at that time, so you can see what the uptown area looked like at that time. And of course, you're home to the Hezekiah Alexander House, which we will talk about. How does this, the Siloam School, which is 2 centuries later, fit into that?
I think it expands the story that we're able to tell at the museum. We've never been the Charlotte Museum of Colonial History. We just kind of focused on that, obviously, because of the house. But it's a testament to the fact that we moved this school here. We are sharing all of Charlotte's history, not just one century, not just one man, not just one building. We want everyone to feel represented and seen when they come to the Charlotte Museum of History. Not colonial history, history,
History.
period.
Terry White's our guest. She's the president and CEO of the Charlotte Museum of History, period, and more. And we'll come back in just a second with it on WFAE's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. We're back with Charlotte Talks and Terry White, who's the president and CEO of the Charlotte Museum of History, talking about some of her accomplishments and her goals and aspects, her aspirations for the future. It may be a history museum, but it has to have a future. Otherwise, why are we talking about it? We were
Amen.
talking about the Siloam School, which was a school built in the early 20s, and it was a school until about 1940, and then it became other things. But when you look at the before pictures, which I did, you would think Think, for those who have not seen this, think of a ramshackle building on a country road as you drive someplace that is falling in. And you think, well, why is that still there? Why don't they tear that down and plow it under? That's what it looked like. What it looks like today is astounding. It looks like a brand spanking new building. But the purpose of it is to go inside and experience what it was like for those children who were educated there in the early 20th century. Is it just walking in amongst the desks? Do you have docents there who explain how does it work?
So yes, you can go in, you can sit on the desks. We sourced 1920s era school desks from old schools across North Carolina. And people love shrinking themselves down into those little things. But we also have an exhibit in what was called the industrial room that kind of explains the history of the Roosevelt School program and the Siloam School specifically. We are working on display cases that will have artifacts that we found through the archaeology for the eras of the school, of the building when it was a school, a home, and an auto shop. Just to kind of show that progression. But in the actual classroom place, we do keep a docent or a volunteer or someone trained to talk about the history of the building and specifically what school would have been like at that time. We also have what is called our Siloam Educator Institute, where we work with teachers on how to incorporate these themes of segregation and separate but not really equal into their curriculums in a way that is relevant and works with the current standards for student education. So we're engaging the education systems. And then we also have special field trips that specifically focus on life of children 100 years ago to try to take kids out of their phones and iPads and connect to the tactile world that was standard in 1924.
Yeah. Even as you were doing this, because it took a long time, I think it took, 8 years to find the money to move the school off the property. I guess it had to be moved because that's a valuable piece of real estate and they wanted to build on it. Take the money to physically move this building on a truck down a highway to Shamrock Drive and then fix it up, paint it, replace some rotted wood, and restore it to its condition that it would have been in 1920. It took a long time, and it took a lot of money, one would think. And we're in the middle of our fund drive, so let's talk about yours. You were struggling with funding. That's nothing new for any museum, I suppose, around the country or any nonprofit. And in fact, the Charlotte Museum of History closed its doors in 2012 for a while because of financial troubles. And even today, as I understand it, you do not get the level of funding that some of the other institutions in town get, like the Mint or the Beckler Museum. Do you understand why?
I think part of it is Charlotte is still a community that is growing into its philanthropy, like we mentioned earlier. So I definitely don't want resources to be diverted away from our brother and sister institutions, the Mint and the Beckler, the Gant. They all deserve every dollar they get and more. But as it's been explained to me, obviously I wasn't here in 2012, we were an institution that was supported by a certain segment of very wealthy people. And as they passed, their wealth went with them. And we had not had a really good plan in place on how to survive without those people and their funding. So we have learned our lesson long before I got here. And that's really why our strategic plans have been in place is to, one, yes, we want to do great exhibits and programs, but we also want to be a fiscally sound and fiscally transparent institution. And so I think that's where my particular skill set comes in, is that, I'm not afraid to ask people for money. All my corporate friends will tell you, she's not. I think it's a lack of awareness. I still to this day get asked, oh, do you mean the Levine? Oh, are you in Uptown? Oh, where is that? And so that's on us. We need to let people know who we are, what differentiates us, and why it's important to support us. As far as the difference, again, I don't think it was any malicious intent. I don't think there were people in a smoky room saying, we're going to ruin the museum. But I think it's just we were out of sight, out of mind. And I'm here to remind people I'm very in your face.
Yeah.
So we are here. So please fund us.
Everything takes money, and everybody has their own budgets at home, and everybody knows what it costs to run their own household. At least I hope they do. But everybody also knows that they probably could do with some more. And
Absolutely.
you received, as I understand it, a mere 15% of the funding that you've asked for. I think you asked for $650,000 and received $100,000. And in fact, you say that for museums to mount the kind of projects that communities expect them to mount would cost six figures a month. Is that sustainable?
Absolutely.
Is that sustainable?
I think it's sustainable, and I think it's, realistic. So when you look at our current budget, we went from a budget operating budget of about 700,000 to currently we're on track to be 1.4 million. That includes salaries and health insurance for 10 employees. So when you talk about the cost of living in Charlotte, I can't pay people $8 an hour to get nationally classed work. That's just not realistic. Everyone wants a fair wage, right? When you talk about building maintenance, think about what your water bill at home is, or if something happens to your water tank. Imagine that on a full-scale museum size. Every time it storms, because we're 8 acres, there are trees that fall down. Those are four or five figure bills that come up every month. We have two exhibits up now, the Hornets exhibit for their 35th anniversary. That was a actually simplified exhibit. That was six figures. The opera exhibit about the National Negro Opera Company, that's a six-figure exhibit because we're paying tradespeople and craftspeople and local businesses to help us produce these things in a way that is nationally classed, high level, that people can actually interact with. Imagine paying $10 to go into a museum and it's janky. And it's like, what the heck did I just give my money to? Well, it costs money, unfortunately, to do that.
Well,
So, what.
let me ask you what if you were funded at the level, your ideal level, whatever that may be, what could you do that you don't do now?
Oh, well, had we gotten our full 650, we could have done free admission for the year. We charge admission because we need the revenue in order to make payroll every 2 weeks. Free admission, when we do have days where people sponsor it or they cover a month of admissions, we see our attendance almost go 7, 8x what it normally is. And we get more people learning and engaging with our materials. So we recognize that a financial burden is keeping people from enjoying our experiences. And we're thinking about that when we talk about pricing for programs and events. Additionally, our building is 25 years old and has not had a major renovation in that time. So if you want to see the best of early 2000 technology, come on in and see what we're working with. So just upgrading the facility so that it's a place where not just our programs, but other nonprofits and creatives and small businesses can also make a way for themselves in the city because more than a third of the money we spend is directly with small businesses with five or fewer employees. When we look at the money that we're spending on women-owned businesses, veteran-owned businesses, minorities, everybody, we are actually tracking how our dollars are invested in the community. So $650,000 would allow us to get the stability to take care of debt from the past, create a reserve fund, and really start to move into a modern, proper museum. And
And despite the fact that you're not fully funded to the level that you'd like to be, you have accomplished this move and restoration of the Siloam School, and now you're turning your attention to the Hezekiah Alexander House. This is the so-called Rock House that is on your property and has been. You didn't have to move it there. That's why you're there on Shamrock Drive. This is the last standing home of a framer of the North Carolina Constitution and North Carolina's first Bill of Rights. It's been an operating exhibit for years. So what restoration work need, and I think the last time it was restored was in 1976. So what restoration needs to be done?
Wow. Well, first is the foundation of the home, 250-year-old house, is bringing in water and moisture like crazy. The landscape has changed over the last 250 years. So we're working every day with dehumidifiers and water removal systems to just keep that basement as dry as possible. That's important because we have mold that grows in certain areas of the home. So mold remediation, pest removal. They say hornets nest in rebellion. Well, the hornets must have all moved inside of the walls of this rock house because they are all over the place. But even simple things like reinterpreting what that space looks like, the way museums and history organizations approached restoration and interpretation 50 years ago is vastly different from what we do today. So there's things like that as far as what is the experience when you walk into the rock house. Small things like replacing the wood in a historically accurate way. My first month here, one of the stairs that went up that you have to walk one to go upstairs just rotted away. It was 250 years old. It was bad, and someone stepped on it and their foot went through. Luckily, it was a staff person. So you can't just, go to Home Depot and get some plywood and fix it. There's a whole process of testing foundations and beams and stairs and walls and historic structures. And then if repairs are needed, going about it in a way that is historically accurate. It's a very lengthy process.
And just so people know,
But
this is an enormous house for its time. This is 5,000 square feet. This is an enormous
absolutely.
house.
It's a decent sized house for today.
I have a minute left. You're in the middle of this 5-year plan that you initiated when you arrived as the head of the Charlotte Museum, and it's set to be finished in 2027. Sometimes things happen and it doesn't quite reach that the finish line, but you structured it around three main pillars: exhibits and collections, people, and financial stability. In less than a minute, where are you on all those three things?
I think we've made a lot of progress in all three. Exhibits and collections. We're rebuilding our collection from what happened about a decade or so ago. And our exhibits and programs, again, we're getting rave reviews and seeing more people than we've seen in years interact with us as an institution. So I think that kind of bleeds into the people part where we want to make sure that we're not just checking boxes to say, oh, we've had this community and this culture. We really want what we put on to be not only reflective of the Charlotte that we live in today, but accessible for people to come and appreciate. So if that's having things in multiple languages, working with the disability community to make sure that they're engaging okay, working with children on the neurodiversity spectrum, that sort of thing. And as far as financial stability, I would go toe to toe with any other arts organization in a fun, friendly way to show how efficient we are with using the resources that we do have. We're Again, our operating budget based on our growth and stability has doubled in 2 years. Earned income 23% up, contributing income doubling year over year. We're on track to be the nationally class, world-class history museum that Charlotte deserves.
Charlotte Museum of History is out there on Shamrock Drive. You can look it up. It's online. It's the home of the Alexander Hezekiah House, some permanent museums in the exhibits, rather, in the actual museum, and of course the Siloam School. Terry White is the president and CEO of the Charlotte Museum of History. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.